Hello and welcome to the podcast for The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. I'm Richard Lane, and in this podcast we're discussing a two-part series published on October the 24th, and this concerns immune-based therapies for type 1 diabetes. Without further ado, let's hear from our guest contributors.
Hi, my name is Mark Atkinson, A-T-K-I-N-S-O-N, and I am the director of the Diabetes Institute at the University of Florida, and a member of the Departments of Pathology and Pediatrics at this institution.
Hi, I'm Bart Roop. I'm a professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Diabetes Immunology and director of the Warnke Family to Cure Type 1 Diabetes at the Diabetes and Metabolism Research Institute at the City of Hope in Los Angeles, California.
Thank you both very much for joining the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology podcast. Mark, perhaps we could start with you, though. Bart, do chip in, and I think it's great you're both going to be responding to all the questions we've got here. Start off with the pathophysiology of type 1 diabetes. Can you just give us some background on this, Mark, and how the pathophysiology of type 1 diabetes potentially lends itself to immune-modulating therapies?
Happy to do that. I'm sure that most of the people in the audience will understand that type 1 diabetes is what we consider an autoimmune disease. It is a disease of inadequate insulin production due to the autoimmune destruction of beta cells. It is a disorder that has been increasing rapidly in terms of its incidence over the last 50 years in particular. It's thought to have both the genetic as well as environmental components. The genetic studies have shown that approximately 50% of the susceptibility to disease occurs around genes relating to the immune responsiveness, with the other some 50 loci that have been identified by GWAS representing a wide swath of the human genome. As far as environmental components that contribute to the disease, there's been many candidates over the years, but unfortunately, as we sit here today, they remain a smoking gun. In terms of there's not been one particular environmental entity that's been unequivocally associated with disease, especially across different populations. The frequency of the disease seems to be increasing rapidly around the world, but perhaps particularly in the underdeveloped world. And the frequency differs quite dramatically based on where you are, meaning the highest region of the world would be in areas around Finland and Scandinavia, where there's parts of China and India where there's thought to be less than one case per 100,000 individuals per year. But the disease is quite debilitating. You have daily lifestyle changes that are unacceptable to many who live with it and struggle with it. Risk for complications remained high. So we need ways to prevent or reverse the disease. And over the years, immune therapies or therapies that target the immune system because of the autoimmune origin have been thought to be perhaps most beneficial. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bart, and he'll explain the experience there.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I still wonder what type 1 diabetes is really caused by. And I say these days that everything I learned as a medical student is wrong. It's not an inherited disease. It's not a children's disease either. It occurs at any age at similar rates. And only recently, when the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation founded a consortium called ENPO to study the diabetic pancreas, we learned what the disease is really all about, and it's completely different from mice. It's very different between individuals. So that opens up quite a few cans of worms, but it also really gives us great pointers to where to move directions and how to prepare for therapies. And one thing that's very clear from these studies that happen to be directed by Mark Atkinson is that there will not be a magic bullet that can cure the disease given the diversity in pathogenesis. Very good news, I think, is that many patients, if not most, keep a residual beta cell mass. They may not be functioning, they may not be secreting insulin, but it does provide a sense of urgency to intervene in the disease progression at any stage, not just the diagnosis, but also afterwards. So these are really exciting times, but to be quite fair, our understanding of the pathogenesis is still increasing every day.
Thank you both. Very interesting and a logical sort of follow-on from that, looking at the potential of immune therapies. I mean, there is no immune therapy yet that has reached the clinic. So what have been the highlights in terms of clinical research development and looking at it more negatively, you know, what have we learned from what hasn't worked so far?
It's a great question, and everybody in the field keeps wondering why we haven't cured diabetes yet, but given the new insight that the disease is diverse, we may have to look back into some of those earlier trials where always you see a subgroup responding. It's not much, and it's maybe, you know, in the dozens at best, but it still shows that something can be done to change the course of events and reverse progression of diabetes. So the real thing is to understand where patients differ and also to maybe combine different therapies. And the latest insight is that it's not just an immune disorder. The beta cell is certainly playing a role in its own demise. So I fear that we won't succeed if we only target the immune system. We should also make islets happy again and make the immune system less interested. Mark, I wonder what you feel there.
I love where you're taking this conversation, Bart, because I really think it goes to the question of, you know, why haven't we succeeded? And part of it is, as Bart implies, that we just didn't have enough understanding of what caused the disease. But then there are other areas, again, those that Bart touched on, from perhaps placing too much emphasis on studies of mouse models and knowing now that they differ so much from humans. But the good news is that we're poised, I think, to make change. And that's what I believe this article, and why we're so happy as co-authors to see it published. I think it does give a roadmap for how we can improve things moving forward in terms of immune therapies. And amongst the article or notions that we put forward in it are, one is, a lot of times we have had performed trials with essentially the goal of either preserving C-peptide or reducing insulin use or reducing episodes of hypoglycemia. Those are all good things, but we probably need to increase our understanding of mechanism when we give a drug. And perhaps another area that we improve on is, again, as Bart noted, is not just to treat the autoimmunity, but try and use combination therapies that would treat either various aspects of the immune response or other aspects, even non-immune related in terms of beta cell function. We believe our field is poised to do better in terms of treating at different stages of the disease. Unfortunately, I think in the past, again, as Bart noted, we viewed type 1 diabetes as one disease, and we perhaps used therapies not with the best utilization on where people were in the natural history, and we think that'll improve moving forward. We're excited to see more and more global networks combine forces to see common protocols and some sort of standardization. Another thing I'm really encouraged on is I think we're being more pragmatic in what we do, meaning we're not just doing therapies that might be able to reach the 0.1%, but something that might reach population. And then, again, just to close, I like to see the notion that we're trying to get more innovative in our trial designs and how they form and how we might not just use staging, but rolling trial designs and the like. So I think these are in some ways the best of times because we've learning from lessons of the past.
Thank you both. Now, paper 2 looks specifically at antigen-based immune therapies. Can you describe how these might work and what have been the most exciting developments to date in this field?
So this is it's a long-held notion in type 1 diabetes that because of the autoimmune nature, that we would perhaps do best to try and develop what it's the golden ring, if you would be tolerance, meaning to try and reach a degree of antigenic non-responsiveness that would benefit people with type 1 diabetes, whether you have the disease or are on the way to developing it. So, and progress is being made in this field in other areas. So, for example, in the fields of allergy, especially in the UK, they're finding ways to tolerize against, say, peanuts and another series of antigens that are associated with disease. And in type 1 diabetes, we have no shortage of beta cell antigens. There are at least four that have been described present in most patients. They're called glutamic acid decarboxylase, or GAD. Insulin is one that's long been described. There's another one, the third one called IA2, and then the fourth one called the ZNTA transporter. And these are just the four major ones. There's other ones that have been described, but they're sort of in lower frequencies. But the thought has been, and I'm going to turn over to Bart here, that through some route of delivery, you could administer these antigens and help modulate disease development. Bart, would you like to carry that further?
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for setting the stage. And to be quite frank, I used to be very pessimistic that antigen-specific therapies could have a future in type 1 diabetes. That had partly to do with our lack of knowledge of which antigens and the fact, as Mark described, they are different between individuals. But the other Mark, Mark Peekman, who is co-authoring our papers, didn't give up and actually shows that you can change the immune response and induce immune regulation. And in the end of the day, we all understand that we need our immune system to defend ourselves against cancer and infections. And that is the major risk giving immune suppressive therapies, which are now the golden standard in all other autoimmune diseases, in RA, in MS, in thyroiditis. We suppress the immune system rather than negotiate with this. So now we change a new era where we actually, with the understanding we have of certain antigens and the diversity between patients, that we can take these antigens and use them as tolerogens, much like what Mark indicated, allergy. So we're a little bit guided with the knowledge we have in allergy. If you know your allergen, you can desensitize. And that's the what we're trying to do in the case of type 1 diabetes. Now, having said that, there are many challenges to overcome, and they include the dosing, where to inject, when. There is all kinds of things where it's actually going to be evidence-based medicine that will take us where we need to be. But the fact that it can be done and that you can actually induce regulatory immune responses to islet antigens specifically, and thereby avoiding that you suppress the response against vaccines and virus and so forth, is really encouraging. And I have become a great optimist from being a vocal pessimist that this actually has a future, if only for the sake of the patients. Because if you get it at the age of 3, I mean, it's no future to give somebody lifelong immune suppression. That's a no-brainer. So we have to do it in more sophisticated ways. And I believe that antigen-specific therapies could be the velvet glove that could change the immune response at least. And then we still have to deal with unhappy islets and beta cells.
Thank you very much. And it's good to hear that you've shifted towards being an optimist now. And perhaps that leads us neatly into the final question, really. Sounds a bit negative, but I think I don't want it to. But, you know, what are the major lessons that have been learned, do you think, emerging from clinical research into immune therapies? And how do you see the future going from here? I think we sort of have already touched on that. But perhaps you could both just revisit that point to finish off, to round off the podcast. Mark, should we come to you first?
So I think Bart said it right up front. I think one of the things, major lessons learned, is if we are going to use preclinical data, that we have to use it far more wisely than we did in the past, because I think this lessons learned has been we've probably lost a bit of time, if you would, in terms of making an impact because of over-utilization of the mouse model or using it inappropriately. I think a second area that I think is, again, poised for the future to make things better is in terms of addressing issues of patient selection, meaning that I think that we're beginning to understand if you develop the disease between, say, 6 months and 3-4 years of age, that may represent one form of diabetes, very aggressive. If you develop it in adolescence to early teen years, that may be another one. Young adult, maybe a third form, and an adult later on, adult onset, yet another form. So I think if we, moving forward, the therapies that Bart and I are speaking on, we'll try and take a look at, again, seeing things work better there. A third area, and then I'll turn it over to Bart after this, I think is we need better biomarkers of the disease. For many years, you know, we've been relying on a limited set of biomarkers, things that not only They've been very successful in terms of helping identify patients at increased risk for disease. But I think moving forward, if we can develop biomarkers that, as Bart mentioned earlier, distinguish responders from non-responders to a therapy, or help us tailor the right therapy to the right person at the right time, I think these will all be things that will help us moving forward.
I completely second all that Mark said. So the insight that a one magic bullet will not suffice is such an important one, and that sets us back to the drawing board. And learning more about disease heterogeneity is an important one. Biomarkers, certainly, even endpoints, because what we try to do with, for example, antigen-specific therapies is induce tolerance. That's not the same thing as waking up sleeping beta cells. So there is something to be learned about that component. So that means that it's going to become even more interdisciplinary when it comes to approaching the disease than it has been so far. And that is something that means that we have to change the attitude of science and turn it into a team science, as is done in different places in the world. That's a very exciting bit, I think, as well. In terms of biomarkers, we just have come to learn that there is a whole new array of targets of the islets. That unhappy islets produce all kinds of stress proteins that turn out to be fantastic immunogens that could activate the immune system. So we may have new means even to prevent this whole process from happening. So these are all exciting opportunities as well as challenges. But as I've said before, I do believe that we already succeeded in some cases, but we just didn't recognize this because we're looking at the group as a whole. And maybe going back to some of these studies, it will point to subgroups of patients, be it adolescents or children or adults, but probably not all of them together, that might have a favorable response to some of the interventions. So that is very exciting. It's also daunting in a way, but at least we think we know where to go, and I hope those papers that we just published will help the community to turn into the right direction.
Indeed. Well, thank you both very much indeed. Extremely articulate, if I may say so, both of you. Very clear. No magic bullet. Lots of